My guest, friends, is the ambassador of Ireland to the United States of America, Dan Mulhall. Ambassador, indeed, you're very welcome.
It's great to be here. Thank you very much for talking to me.
Let me ask you, for openers, a little bit about your own background. Waterford.
Waterford, that's right, yeah. Well, I was born in Waterford and grew up there, and my whole life for the first 17 years was Waterford-based because my family were unusual in Irish terms in that my mother was one of eight, and they all remained in Waterford, which that era must have been pretty exceptional. My father was the only child, as it happened, and so basically I had 50 or more cousins in Waterford and nobody anywhere else. So we went on our holidays, of course, every year around the country, and once or twice went outside it. But my knowledge of the world was really very limited, I have to confess. And I went to Cork in 1972, and I did my degree in history and literature. And I suppose my initial idea was that I would probably end up in academia. That was probably my kind of destination. And then I stumbled into the Department of Foreign Affairs, and 40 years later, here I am.
But you've had a lot of firsts in your life. Having joined Foreign Affairs in 78, if I'm
78, correct, that's right,
to become an ambassador for the first time in countries, that had to be somewhat of an experience that many others said. What did they say? Where are you from?
Well, no, I mean, growing up in Waterford, I never expected to be Ireland's ambassador anywhere. Even when I joined the Department of Foreign Affairs in 1978, the process of being ambassador was a very, very remote one. It was in the distant, dim future, and it might never be reached as far as I was concerned. As my career progressed, I moved up the ladder, and eventually I got my first head of mission posting in Edinburgh in 1998, which was not an ambassadorial assignment, of course, but a consul general in Edinburgh. And that was a very exciting time to be there because that was the time of devolution. It was also the time of the peace process, the Good Friday Agreement, and so on. And my first ambassadorial assignment was in Malaysia in 2001. It was fascinating again to go to the Far East and to be the ambassador, not just to Malaysia, but also Thailand, Vietnam, Laos, and what's now called Myanmar. So I had five countries to cover, which was quite challenging, but also fascinating because, of course, those countries are very different from each other and very different from Europe, obviously. And I was there during the Asian tsunami in 2004, which was a very traumatic experience because I had to spend 3 weeks in Phuket, surrounded by devastation and looking for, first of all, Irish people who are missing and injured and get them home. And then eventually, sadly, it was a case of looking for the remains of those Irish who had perished in that terrible catastrophe.
We can barely imagine what that kind of devastation is. You went on from there, though, and you served for a good while as ambassador in London from 2013 to 17.
Yeah.
Was London and was that assignment, was that very different from anything that
Totally. I mean, it's obviously a privilege to be Irish ambassador anywhere in the world, so I would be happy anywhere serving Ireland.
Yeah.
That's part of our mission. It's part of our creed as members of the Department of Foreign Affairs. You serve where the government chooses to send you, and I've always been happy to take whatever assignments came my way. But clearly, there are a couple of countries in the world, well, more than a couple, there are a number of countries in the world where we have special ties. And one of those is obviously Britain. And the other one is obviously the United States, and then Australia, Canada, and so forth as well. So to be chosen to go to London as ambassador is a special privilege, because there you're dealing with a country that has huge connections with Ireland, where the workload there is almost unlimited, because you have 700,000 Irish-born people in Britain, remember, and you have an economic relationship which is second to none. You have the relationship connected with Northern Ireland, which is vital for Ireland and for Britain indeed. You have the relationship within the European Union, which has obviously been very important for the last 45 years, and now as Britain leaves, is becoming, you know, difficult again for us. And I was there, of course, for the 2016 referendum and the aftermath to it. So I saw the entire Brexit process being born, and I saw the start of it being delivered, and I've been watching with dismay, obviously, this past year and a half as to what's been happening in Britain and the, you know, the lack of progress, the lack of agreement on exactly what it means to leave the European Union in Britain's case.
It's you being, you know, a diplomat of great note, it's not for me to draw any to draw any comparisons between, you know, what is going on in Washington, what's going on in this country and in Brexit. But for some reason, there is a feeling, I think, among Irish Americans that maybe for the first time, we really don't have any input into this, you know, on immigration, on you know, all our ties. Before, it seemed like Irish America, hey, you really wanted to pitch in, you wanted to do something, you wanted to have, you know, other than the goodwill, which is many times offset by the confusion of this whole Brexit thing. It kind of leaves us, you know, kind of in the middle of nowhere and wondering whether, in fact, because of our current, you know, political strife and dealing with our own elected officials, it is Britain. Is anybody saying, looking at America, to say, as in fact, you know, we saw with Northern Ireland, where you had a special envoy, are we? Is that even on the cards? Is that different?
I see what you mean, and I understand fully. It is true, of course, that for Irish America, the Northern Ireland conflict was a very particular issue, which Irish Americans played a hugely important role in convincing the American administration and Congress to take a more active role with regard to Northern Ireland, which eventually paid off in the form of the Good Friday Agreement. And likewise, during the economic and financial crisis of 10 years ago, Irish Americans in positions of influence economically were able to come back and provide some support and guidance for Ireland. And I understand how people might say, well, how can we possibly get our heads around this Brexit business?
Right.
However, don't underestimate the importance of Irish America in the context of Brexit. Because Brexit, while it is true that it has, Ireland is now focusing more and more attention on our continental European partners, because they're the ones we need to build links with. I mean, in the past, we had a relationship with Britain, which was important in the EU, because Britain was a powerful country. Britain is leaving. We have to find new allies within the European Union, or we have to build deeper alliances with those countries that we've been partners with for 45 years. So the focus is very much on Europe. However, don't underestimate the new world that Brexit will bring into being, whereby Ireland will be the only English-speaking country in the European Union. Don't underestimate the capacity for Ireland to play a bigger role in transatlantic relations. And certainly don't underestimate the capacity of Irish Americans to be influential in ensuring that Ireland plays that role, and that Ireland's value as a bridge between the United States and Europe is recognized by Americans.
That is refreshing, and is, you know, a great part of us that says, well, we're here if anybody wanted us. And maybe there are a lot of things that can happen that don't get the, you know, exposure, that are not as newsworthy because of all the other items that seem to be of immediate interest. I want to ask you, though, about, maybe you can lay the fears of many that might say, you know, the UK and many of the citizens of Britain who may not have any ties with Northern Ireland, and who you know, just don't have, couldn't care less about what's happening in Northern Ireland, because that has been preempted by their own interest in what's going to happen here. Would some say, you know something, if it weren't for the issue of Northern Ireland, this Brexit thing would be much easier to resolve?
For Ireland, Brexit is an all-of-government, all-policy areas challenge, because when you think about it, there's hardly a single area of public policy where Ireland doesn't have important relationships with the UK because of proximity and traditional links and so on. And for the last 45 years, a lot of those connections are being conducted within the European Union. And therefore, when Britain leaves the European Union, a new basis for those relationships has to be created. So, I would say we have three major challenges now. And these are not in any order. But yeah. Let's take the easiest one, or the one that's least well known. And that is all the things that we have to regulate with the UK, transport links, environment issues, energy connections between the two countries. All those things are highly practical, essential that we get them sorted, because we need to have normal life, needs to continue after Brexit, right? That's the first thing. The second thing, and this is vitally important to Ireland, is our trading relationship with the UK.
Yeah.
So, for example, today, our biggest trading partner is the United States. Our second biggest is the UK. But that's slightly deceptive, because for Irish-owned companies, small and medium-sized enterprises in Ireland, particularly companies in rural areas, food companies, agricultural companies, and so on, for them, the British market's very large. So anything that makes trade with Britain more difficult from an Irish point of view is damaging to us economically. And then the third issue is the one that gets most attention, which is Northern Ireland. And that's both an economic and a political concern. Economic, because, of course, we do trade with Northern Ireland, and especially in border counties, there's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing. And, for example, the 30% of all the milk that's produced in Northern Ireland is processed in the south. And likewise, many farmers in the south send their animals across the border to be slaughtered in Northern Ireland to be exported to Britain there's a lot of economic to-ing and fro-ing between North and South. But of course, the issue that bothers people most of all is what happens to the border. And the Irish government's position from the beginning has been absolutely solid. There cannot be a border on the island of Ireland, because it simply doesn't work. You cannot do it. It would be economically disruptive, and it would be politically very risky. And therefore, and to be fair to them, the British government has the same view.
Right.
They don't want a border either. The EU doesn't want a border. And nor does any political party in Northern Ireland. There's no political party in Northern Ireland campaigning for a border between North and South, right?
Yeah, hardly.
Unionists are nationalists. They all want to see an open border. The problem is, how do you achieve that outcome? If Britain leaves the single market, leaves the customs union, then somehow trade between North and South would become the subject. It would become trade between a third country and the European Union, and therefore it would create complications when it comes to customs and other issues that control trade between the EU and other parts of the world. Now, the government's position has been, we can't have a border, everyone's agreed to that, and the current withdrawal agreement has in it a backstop, which is it's an insurance policy, and it says that we hope that this insurance policy will never be needed.
Mm-hmm.
It's like when you buy an insurance policy, you hope you'll never need it.
Yes.
But it's there in case you do, in case you get sick and you have your health insurance, right? So the backstop means that we hope that Britain and the EU will be able to negotiate such a close economic relationship that customs controls and border controls won't arise. But we say if we don't manage to do that, we need to have a guarantee, an insurance policy, that at that stage the backstop kicks in. And unfortunately, the current withdrawal agreement was defeated by a large margin in the Westminster Parliament a couple of weeks ago. I mean, our hope would be that somehow a sensible, pragmatic British withdrawal from the EU will be possible, which will minimise the disruption for Ireland. But there is a risk, of course, of a disruptive Brexit, and that's the thing that nobody wants to see, and everything possible must be done to avoid that outcome.
Would how high in ranking is the fear that, in addition to having the horrific inconvenience, the emphasis on trade and customs and all of that, how real is the fear in the South, which we at least feel, and I'm sure it's likewise in the North, that it is, opening the gates to, a segment of those who feel, that that the previous IRA, that the not just the IRA, but the unionist and nationalist movements, and that the dissidents would be saying that, boy, this is working out pretty good. Can that feature in any of the political negotiations, or is this the chicken and the egg? Let's get the border issue finished, and hopefully we won't even have to address the other.
Well, there's no justification in any circumstance for any return to violence, and the violence has proven itself in the past to be counterproductive in many ways, and there's no justification. No matter what happens with Brexit, that cannot be used to justify any sort of return to violence. But we do know that the political situation in Northern Ireland is not ideal at the moment.
Hmm.
After all, it's now more than 2 years since the executive functioned. During that time, it's not been possible, despite Herculean efforts on the part of the Irish government and others to restore the executive, that hasn't been possible to achieve. And that's an unfortunate situation. And what it means is that
it's difficult for us, ambassador, to
say,
wait a minute.
The situation is polarized in Northern Ireland. And then that's bad enough. But into that mix, you throw the Brexit issue, which creates a further set of divisions within Northern Ireland. Now, they're not strictly speaking unionist nationalists, but because obviously many unionists voted in favour of remaining in the EU.
Yeah.
But they do tend to complicate the already complex political situation in Northern Ireland. So, from the very beginning, the Irish government's had some key principles which our European partners have been solidly behind. Protect the Good Friday Agreement, protect the achievements that have flown from it, and don't allow a hard border to turn the clock back and give rise to a risk that somehow people with malign intentions might exploit that situation. However unjustified that might be, the risk is there, and that's part of what drives us. But the biggest thing of all is that these arrangements that have been on the island of Ireland now for the last 25 years, due to the single market, due to the end of the conflict in Northern Ireland, have worked extremely well for everyone in Ireland. The fact that now, when you travel from south to north, you don't even realise you've crossed the border.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that people go back and forth across the border all the time. I mean, many people in Donegal and other counties around go to work in Derry every day.
Yeah.
People from Derry go to work in Letterkenny. So the two parts of the island have grown closer together, and that's a process that has to continue because it's still not what it should be.
Right.
But it has the potential to evolve further in the future. What we don't want to see is something like this that turns the clock back and that you end up making it more difficult for people to do business across the border, to travel across the border for business purposes, to visit family, as tourists or whatever. And that's why...
And it's such a big part of tourism.
And that's why it's so vital for us. So vital that we, at all costs, that we must prevent a hard border from being installed on the island of Ireland, because that would really be turning the clock back in a very, very unfortunate way. And I simply, the Irish government has consistently ruled it out. But basically, we have to find a solution to this problem. I mean, everyone wants the outcome, an open border, but the solution that will deliver that has not yet been found, or at least it hasn't been agreed by all sides.
The goalpost, can that be with the, you know, the deadline, you know, barreling closer, and the situation, if anything, being as fragile as, or maybe sometimes more fragile now, would, as many suggest here, with respect to, you know, getting our own 800,000 plus federal employees back in the job, is there a reality or a possibility, a good possibility, that goalpost can be shoved ahead for another year, couple of years, you know? Does anybody want that at the moment?
That's obviously not a matter for Ireland to decide. That's a matter for people in Britain, for the British Parliament in particular, to decide. But it's clear that as the day of Brexit, the end of March of this year, dawns and comes nearer all the time, the situation is becoming more and more urgent. And I think you will see continued urgent efforts both in Britain but also in the European Union to try to find a solution. Now we have to see how the vote goes next week when the issue is put back to the British Parliament. Now that we've only 2 months to go before the day when Britain leaves the EU, will that change minds? Will that encourage more people in? I mean, we would like to see the withdrawal agreement endorsed by the British Parliament, because that withdrawal agreement gives us what we want, what we need. It's not ideal for us. We prefer if Britain stayed in the European Union. Don't get me wrong. We prefer if they somehow decided to drop this whole business, because we think it's been a disaster for everyone. But we have to be realistic, and so we would like to see them leave in the way that the withdrawal agreement provides for. In other words, an orderly departure.
An orderly.
That minimises the disruption for Ireland and for our other Europe, and for Northern Ireland, and for Britain, and for our European partners. So everyone will benefit from an orderly departure. The problem is that there's no agreement on how that will be achieved. And there are those in Britain who argue that you need to push back the decision and provide more time for further discussions and so on. And that may happen, but that's not for us to decide. Right. That's a matter for the British to determine.
You know, probably one of the most successful and laudatory Irish government initiatives worked so well in the United States, and speaking, of course, of the centenary of 1916. All of those who might have thought or said that, you know, you're raking up coals there, and who knows, and what's to benefit. All the naysayers were indeed just that. They're naysayers. It was a tremendous success, I think, on both sides of the Atlantic, for Americans and, of course, tourism through the roof, for Americans who went to Ireland. They were very impressed with the dignified celebration and commemoration. And likewise, here, right throughout the United States, again, with very strong support of the Irish government and of all the organizations here, who, in fact, many, there were predictions that, certain elements of Irish America, you know, would want to have nothing to do with it. Nothing could be further from the truth. So we have a great reason for celebration that everything went as well as it did. I'm not sure, though, if we were ready or that many people would be familiar with, the significance, of the centenary celebrations of 1918. And, maybe fill us in, if you will, on the significance.
Let me say first of all that I was in Britain for the centenary of 1916, and that was where the rubber hit the road, because that was where you might expect that there would be a negative reaction. And in fact, in the months leading up to 2016, I had a few people, senior people in Britain, who came to me and said they were worried about trouble being stirred up between Britain and Ireland and in Northern Ireland because of the 1916 commemorations. I took the view that the best way to deal with this was to be open and to embrace all aspects of our history. So, believe it or not, there were a couple of days in 2016 when I attended a Somme commemoration in the morning and a 1916 Easter Rising event in the evening in London and Manchester and Liverpool, right? So I found a way of commemorating both of those events.
Yeah.
Just because a Somme, after all, involved thousands of Irish casualties, yeah, including...
It was commemorated
including
here.
Including people like Tom Kettle, who's a great nationalist writer, Francis Ledwidge, the emerging Irish poet who lost his life during the First World War. So I set out to do the thing sensitively. And I found that, by and large, British people were curious.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to know more about it. And provided you presented, and I gave talks at Oxford, Cambridge, Edinburgh, Glasgow, Manchester, Liverpool, about the Easter Rising, and I never once had anyone come to me and make any kind of political point about it. I mean, people came along, they wanted to know more about this thing, they heard about it, and indeed, the coverage in the British media was quite positive. Now, we did a very good job, because my feeling in 2016 was that, the great thing about it was that we were tolerant. We didn't just want to hear one version.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to hear different views in 1916, and we wanted to compare and contrast and form our own views. And people genuinely were curious about what happened in 1916. I don't think it did any disservice. I think the people of the men and women of 1916 were honored with great ceremony. But we didn't go down the road of banging the drum and praising ourselves and beating our breasts about how wonderful we were. And now 1918 is a different story. But I think it's an equally important story, because that was the time when the Irish electorate, including women for the first time in history,
that's right,
voted decisively to reject the Irish Party, a party that in 1910 had 73 seats, ended up with 6 seats in 1918, because there was no general election during the First World War. So they basically were wiped out. Right, except in Northern Ireland, where they held on for a while. On the other hand, people who nobody knew anything about, the people who represented Sinn Féin, which was a national movement basically at that time, contained, because after all, the Sinn Féin of that election is the mother party to Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Sinn Féin, and even you could say the Labour Party, because Labour didn't actually take part in that election, and they allowed Sinn Féin a free pass. So... And by the way, the Irish people, instead of going for the safe option, we'll choose the experienced men of the Irish Party, said, no, we want a new generation, we want a new breed of politician, we want a new group of people to take forward our ambitions as a nation. And then a month later, those 27 of those 73 people, the rest were in jail, met in Dublin, in a mansion house. And they could have just met and sort of, you know... formed a committee and appointed office holders and so on. What did they do? They made a declaration of independence on the first day. They issued a democratic program giving the ambitions for the future of Ireland, and they issued a message to the free nations of the earth. So they didn't just sit back and say, let's be careful, let's be cautious. No, they went boldly to declare independence. And by the way, Declaration of Independence, that wording was not chosen by accident. That was designed to echo the Declaration of Independence in 1776. And to make the point that Ireland was now joining the community of nations in the way that America had 140 odd years before.
Yeah.
That's why it's important.
The establishment of the Foreign Service, we say, well, what happened before that? Well, that's... There wasn't even a need to go there, because there was not such a foreign service from Ireland. Now we have Ireland, our own Declaration of Independence, and now, in addition to making that declaration, you've mentioned, we now have to get the word out through the world, and we have to get Ireland, the stripe of Ireland, out very differently. What were the baby steps there?
Well, there was a coincidence in the fact that 2 days before the first Dáil met on the 21st of January 1919, the Versailles Peace Conference opened in Paris, at the end of the First World War. And of course, Woodrow Wilson had issued his great 14-point declaration, which basically said that there should be self-determination for small nations, because it was an anti-imperial declaration of principles which would guide the post-war world. Now, it didn't work out in the way that Wilson intended, because the American Congress wouldn't support the League of Nations and so on. But anyway, that's another story. But the point is that what was happening in Ireland was happening in a global context. There was a wind of change. Remember, right, all these other countries were emerging as well, because the Austro-Hungarian Empire fell apart, the German Empire fell apart, and the Russian Empire fell apart, and the Turkish Empire. So the four big empires,
yes,
of the 19th century all crumbled, and all these new countries emerged. So that was what was happening in the world. So naturally, and the Irish also, of course, were an outward-looking people, because they already had a family of people connected with them in America, in Australia,
right,
and throughout the world. And a lot of recent
Immigrants because of the famine.
Sure. So they realized that we were not going to be just a little country trying to break free from Britain, that we're going to have to mobilize our resources around the world. And the main resource, of course, was in the United States, where there were many, many motions passed in state houses all over the country. Congress passed motions and so on. Unfortunately, Woodrow Wilson didn't really listen to those pleas, and he refused to talk to the Irish delegation, which consisted of Sean T. O'Kelly, Michael McWhite, who subsequently became the second Irish representative in Washington, by the way. The first was Timothy Smitty, the second one was Michael McWhite. But they were sent over to Versailles, the day after the Dáil met, they were sent off to Versailles. And, of course, they made an impact there, and they met American delegations, but they weren't able to get into the peace conference because, of course, while Wilson's vision was of a world of self-determination, that didn't apply to Ireland, because Ireland was part of the UK, and therefore the UK prevented any access to the peace conference for Ireland. But that was the start of Ireland's journey as an international entity. And within a couple of years, representatives were sent to America, were sent to France, to Germany, to Italy, and to Latin America. So very quickly, even before we became formally independent in 1922, we had representatives around the world banging the drum and connecting with Irish communities, trying to mobilize international support for Ireland. So that was the beginnings of our foreign policy, which has been going on now for 100 years. And it's a great thing that now that we've reached 100 years as the Department of Foreign Affairs, that we now have this new policy called Global Ireland, which is to double Ireland's global footprint in the world in the next 10 years.
And actually, before we shift from that, from the centenary celebration, and this time we don't have to shuffle about whether it's a commemoration or a celebration, it's a celebration. And where are, where is the Irish government emphasis in getting the story out in terms of the significance of this? Is that mostly in the foreign affairs?
No, it's an all-of-government effort. For example, there was a big gathering on the 21st of January in Dublin, where speakers of parliaments all over Europe and beyond were invited. In fact, Joe Crowley, former Congressman Crowley, represented the United States. A very appropriate choice indeed, someone with a distinguished political record and also with a strong Irish background. So it was a kind of a global celebration of... Because, you see, We're not celebrating one event, by the way, there.
All right.
We're celebrating 100 years of Irish democracy. I mean, you think about it. Who would have imagined in January 1919 that that sort of new parliament with no background, with young people, had no experience of politics or of parliament, who could have believed that they would have set in train an unbroken century of parliamentary democracy? Mm. Through the troubles, through the ups and downs of international politics, the Second World War, the Depression, the changes of the Cold War and so on, that Ireland would have remained a parliamentary democracy, an unbroken parliamentary democracy in a troubled world and in the wake of our own war of independence and, more importantly and more dangerously, our own civil war, which divided people in very serious ways in Ireland. But somehow that seed that was sown there in the Mansion House in 1919 has grown into 100 years of parliamentary democracy. And it's a record that few European countries have an unbroken record of that kind. And certainly most of the countries that became independent in the wake of the First World War had lost their democratic credentials within 20 years because of developments in the wider world.
My guest, Franz, is the Ambassador of Ireland to the United States of America, Dan Mulhall. Ambassador, Waterford, a great county of music and entertainment, and speaking of ambassadors, you know, you've had so many around the world. A little bit on your own background and your own house, and particularly with your mother being one of eight, were there fiddlers, musicians, singers?
No, actually, on my mother's side, not really. But what I remember from my childhood, I'm talking about the early 60s now, so yeah. Pre-television era, really. What I remember is, particularly in my paternal grandmother's house, gatherings of family members and a lot of singing and storytelling going on. Even though it was an urban environment, so it wasn't like we were in the countryside. We lived in the centre of Waterford, in the older part of Waterford. So, but I do remember my grandfather, my paternal grandfather, was a member of the Light Opera Society in Waterford and was a fine singer. And my grandmother actually, who lived until she was in her mid-90s, I mean, I can remember her singing at family events when she was in her mid-90s, a year before she died. She could still do a mean version of Danny Boy. So there wasn't much instrumental music in the family, but there certainly were. My sisters are good singers. So even to this very day, when we gather, as we do in Waterford, a sing-song is quite often a feature of our family get-togethers. And of course, this is something that most other countries in the world have no experience of. It's not something that people in other countries really do. And in fact, at the embassy in London, we did it quite a lot. But even in fact, in Washington, we're very fortunate that we have a fair number of people in our community there who are quite good singers. You know, and in fact. In fact,
they're not all down there too, because I'll tell you what, in the consulate here, in the consulate in New York here, even without our esteemed Consul General Kieran Madden, there's a lot of talent here, a tremendous amount of talent.
No,
but I think the impromptu ambassador, it's the impromptu nature of the Irish and from whence we come, that at some point during the evening, if it has been going relatively quietly without any cultural exhibition of any kind, if somebody stands up, they're either standing up to leave or to get this going. And to get this going has to do with let's sing, let's recite, let's dance. It's in our.
It is, and recently in Washington, I had a farewell dinner for Congressman Joe Crowley, and that ended up with a great sing song because he himself is very talented guitar player and sings a pretty good song as well. And our Christmas party this year, we ended up with about 40 people. After most of the guests had left, we ended up with about 40 people crammed into our study. And we had a sing-song that lasted about 3 hours. And we sang every song under the sun. And we had a couple of guitar players there. And it was great fun. And so I still think that is quintessential Irishness, and long may it continue. You know, one of the things that I am happiest about is that although our country has changed dramatically in almost every respect, look at the way, the prosperity, the infrastructure is so much more modern now than it was. 50% of Irish people between 25 and 50 have third level degrees. But we haven't lost that sort of joie de vivre, or that kind of, that sense of crack that gets people singing and telling stories and being kind of outgoing and hospitable. And, you know, you go to an Irish gathering and there'll always be a hum of conversation and it'll be a noisy environment. You go to other places in the world and you go to a public space and there are whispered conversations going on. We don't do whispered conversations, I'm glad to say. We understand that being gregarious is an essential part of what we are as Irish people.
Just want to, but before we move on, and there are a couple of topics that I must address, but there's a new commemorative coin in Ireland. This is launched to mark the 100 years since Irish women won the right to vote. And just, if you wouldn't mind, just address, women suffrage in Ireland and the significance of this.
Well, here's the way I look at this. You have to ask the question, how did Ireland go from, in 1910, being content to vote for people who wanted home rule and who'd been around for 20 or 30 years, Redmond, Dillon and all of those, like fine people, some politicians. How was it that in 1918 they decided to abandon that approach and to go for a new breed of politician, including women, including a woman in the case of Constance Markovitz? And I would say that part of the explanation for that has to be the fact that women had the vote for the first time in 1918. So, for example, the men who were voting that time, who may have voted 4 or 5 times or 10 times before, they were used to voting for certain people that they kind of trusted. The women were voting for the first time. They had no record. So I think it was the women's suffrage that actually helped to turn the 1918 election into a transformative moment for Ireland. So, because, of course, Irish women had been radicalised over the preceding 20 years by the suffrage movement, which was actually quite strong in Ireland, and it was connected with the suffrage movement in other parts of the world. Indeed.
Including here.
I just saw a story during the week there. Hannah Shee Skeffington came to America in 1917. She was here for several months, 1917, 1918. She spoke at 250 meetings across 21 states. Can you imagine that?
Yes.
An incredible tour. So obviously she had an audience here among the Irish, of course, mm-hmm. because of her husband's dreadful killing during the Easter Rising, where he was trying to prevent looting and was shot, summarily shot by a deranged British officer. But she also, of course, was well received here because she was a suffragist, that she was connected with the suffrage movement here in the United States. So there was something in the air in the early part of the 20th century.
Her granddaughter.
And in particular, it was this sense that women were emerging into the public sphere for the first time.
Yeah, and lest she and others be forgotten, a lot of the descendants of the remarkable women, she being, one of the most prominent, have actually, made sure that as we go forward, that they're very much part of our history, of our American history as well. That's good. I want to ask you, in this global market that we live in, and particularly on the cultural aspects of what today is, would have been even as little as 20 years ago, we would have been struggling to see, well, do we really need to be global? And if so, is that going to drain our own DNA? Is that going to, or do we have to get into this melting pot? How did Ireland make, and how has Ireland made as much headway in culture and arts? Particularly, I know we've done it for more than a century, but particularly in the last couple of decades, we seem to be way out there and ahead of that.
I've witnessed the transformation of Ireland, maybe in an unusual way, because I've been spent a lot of my life overseas, but I've constantly been working on Irish issues, and I've been back and forth all the time, and I spent, you know, a number of times, I was posted in Ireland, for 3 or 4 years at a time, so I haven't been out of Ireland consistently, but I've been out of Ireland quite a bit. And, you know, last week in Dublin, we had a conference of our ambassadors from around the world. And at the end of the conference, they sent us all down to our local areas to visit schools. And I visited my school in Waterford, Mount Sion. It was the first Christian Brothers school in the world, founded by Edmund Ignatius Rice.
In the world?
Yeah, in 1803. Okay. Because Edmund Rice, who was a Callan man, from South Kilkenny, founded the order in 1803, and Mount Sion was the first school that he opened. And when I was at school in the 1960s and early 70s, the diversity in the school was provided by people who came across the bridge from South Kilkenny, from Kilmacow and Mooncoyne and these places, right? I went there this time to my old school, and they had about 150 boys from the senior classes come to meet me. They had 22 language groups, and each language group spoke in their own language for, a couple of sentences in their own language. So and this was captured on video. And it went viral for a while because people saw this as a really good thing, a really good expression of how Ireland has changed. So my view of all of this is that Ireland has a tolerance that other countries don't seem to have been able to maintain. We shouldn't be complacent about it because it doesn't necessarily last forever. But certainly at the moment, at least, my sense of my old school in Waterford and the other schools I visited, which were also obviously got people from different parts of the world as pupils. My sense is that people are taking a sense of pride in this rather than being threatened by it. And, you know, I had a great experience there. My last outing, my last public event in London before I left, was I went to Coventry, to St. Finbar's GAA club in Coventry.
Yeah.
And I went there for a GAA tournament, a kids' tournament. And I was there to, you know, officiate and give out the prizes at the end of the tournament. And I went on to, to be photographed on the pitch with the under-15s who were having a Gaelic football match. And the guy that was refereeing the game was clearly had an African background. Right? As I walked towards him to shake his hand, I saw that he had the tracksuit of Mount Sion GAA Club, right? And I realised that he was a fellow graduate of Mount Sion, and we had a photograph taken, and it was, to my mind, a fantastic expression of the wonderful changes that have occurred in modern Ireland. Here you had a kid with an African background, grew up in Ireland, was a great Gaelic footballer, a great hurler, and was now teaching Gaelic football and hurling to kids in Coventry in 2017. Fancy that, eh? And my sense is that a lot of these kids I met last week in Waterford will end up doing the same thing. They'll end up acquiring a genuine grow for Irish culture and for Irish sports and so on, and will actually be an asset to the country in many ways in the future. But I think they will, in their time in Ireland, if they stay in Ireland, which many will acquire an Irish culture. They end up, you know, following the local GAA team, following their county team, and so on. And I think that's a good thing. It's a good thing. And you have now, various people around the country, various county teams that have players that are on the verge of county honours, who have backgrounds that would not be typically Irish in the Ireland that I grew up in. So I'm not worried about this. I think it's a reflection of Ireland being a modern, developed country, that people actually want to come to Ireland now. We have 17% of our population now were born outside the country. But I see that as an asset to our country, because a lot of these people are highly qualified, and they're helping our economy to maintain its cutting edge, which is vital for the future, especially as we face the challenges of Brexit. Because Britain is going to start suffering from not being able to bring people in from outside, from having a barrier to people right. coming in. We're going to benefit from being open to the world.
To have the establishment of 5 cultural ambassadors now ready to, excuse the pun, you know, to build their footprint on the globe, as it were. Is this, many would say, well, you're doing that already. You've had great success. Success in the sense that great recognition. It used to be that if musicians or if artists, left Ireland, they left Ireland primarily for economic reasons. Ireland was too small, or at least that was the image, that it was, as you know, it was very small. Now you have a great number of artists, and of course, musicians and right across the arts that have actually made a name for themselves in places on the map that we couldn't even find. So there is some huge recognition that Ireland, is this great, it has a great wealth and a fountain of culture. And even if it means that, you know, when you have people in China crying out for, you know, whether that's Dedan and the Saw Doctors, or for that matter, and obviously opera concerts, but the varied and tremendous diversion and variety of Irish arts, and I'm only talking about the musicians and singer because they come to mind more readily. But this has to be something. I mean, you can't really market that unless it's of great interest to countries.
Well, in my experience traveling the world, we have a precious asset, and that is that we don't have to force feed our culture to people around the world. They actually want it. And they'd want it even if we never had an Irish embassy or an Irish foreign service. They want it because it relates to them in some way. I came across that, first of all, in India, where back in the early 80s, a lot of people in India, a lot of Indians were very interested in Irish literature because it spoke to them, because the experience of the Irish was sort of not dissimilar to the Indians, and being downtrodden and having to assert their identity and so forth. And then all around the world, wherever I've been, I've had the same experience, that our culture opens doors for us. In Germany, for example, you could go to any German city or town any night of the week. There'll be a band playing Irish music somewhere in that town. And good Irish music.
Yeah.
A lot of them will be Germans who are obsessed with Irish music and who play it. And I always thought, when I travel around, isn't this amazing? There are European countries far bigger than ours.
Right.
Who wouldn't dream of ever being able to find a musician or music from their country being played in Germany every night of the week. There are 2 magazines in Germany that exist to kind of inform Germans about the Irish cultural offerings that are available every night of the week, every week of the year throughout Germany. And the same is obviously true in Britain and the United States. So it is a great calling card for us. And for example, I had dinner with a European ambassador there last week, and and I of a country bigger than ours, not France or Britain, but a middle-sized European country, larger than ours. And like, when I mentioned that there are a dozen universities here in the United States that are teaching Irish studies, that there are numerous universities that have holdings of Irish material that are extensive and impressive, this ambassador couldn't fathom it, because his own country could not even dream of that sort of thing. There's just no equivalent to that. So we are lucky that we have, mainly because we have the Irish diaspora, but also because of the fact that we happen to be an English-speaking country, which is something that we didn't maybe intend for ourselves, but it's happened, but it has given our literature, for example, a global reach. And that's why every morning of the year now, I tweet some Irish poetry, because I do it in order to demonstrate to people that this is a living literary culture, and I want to show it off on the Twitter sphere. I want to provide something for people to think about rather than to be angry about.
All right, Áine Sheridan, who is the executive producer of programming, has made it quite easy for me to plead ignorance when it comes to Twitter and all that other stuff. I learned my lesson very early in that when Áine took over our company, and I made one fax copy one day. From that day forward, nobody would make a fax copy for me. I'm aging myself. But Áine, on that Twitter, you'll be able to fill us in on the ambassador's...
My Twitter handle is at Dan Mulhall, and you'll find me on Twitter quite easily. In fact, I'm sure many of your listeners are probably Twitter fans, and if they want some... So if they want some Irish poetry every morning, they should follow me, and I'll provide that service to them happily. I started doing this for the 150th anniversary of the birth of W.B. Yeats, and towards the end of the year, I tweeted every day a Yeats poem, a Yeats quote, and towards the end of the year, I was about to give it up, and, you know, the year was over, and I kept getting people coming to me and saying, you have to keep it going. So I've kept it going, and I get wonderful feedback on it. I really do. I mean, I don't get any kind of nasty stuff really on Twitter. I don't attract that kind of nasty attention. But the attention I attract is all people saying, I love your daily tweets. It's the best thing on Twitter every day. Now, I'm sure that's not true, but for most people, because it's a gentle early morning feed of some fine poetry with some, you know, nice ideas being conveyed, people like it, and they respond well to it. I'm going to keep doing it for as long as I can.
Yeah, and you're providing a great service for those who wouldn't get up in the morning and figure, where can I get, you know, some great Irish poetry?
Some inspiration.
Inspiration. Let me ask you, because I'm inclined to, to give examples of Irish culture as singing, as dancing, as, literature, our poetry, and obviously our great writers. The Irish government is setting out on a plan to further establish and expand on an Irish footprint globally. Is there an index? Is there an overall plan? Do you have a top 20? How does that work?
Well, there is a plan called Global Ireland, which is available, and you can download it and read it quite easily. Essentially, I suppose it has a number of strands to it. One is to increase our diplomatic presence in the world. Mm. When I first started, we had about 25 missions around the world. At the end of this program, we have more than 100, so we will become a properly developed European country with the same number of missions as, say, Norway, Denmark, Sweden, and countries that we would compare ourselves with, countries of an equivalent size and orientation and global outlook, right? Secondly, our development aid program is going to expand dramatically. In fact, the estimate is that by 2030, we should have a budget in our Irish aid program of about between 2.5 and 3 billion euros. So very substantial aid program, which will give us connections all over the world and will allow us to provide support for development in sub-Saharan Africa and elsewhere. And then there's the United Nations,
mm-hmm.
where we're looking for a seat on the Security Council in 2021-22 to mark the
and send a good shot.
I think so.
I mean,
we have a very strong offer. We have a very strong case to make, and our diplomats around the world are making that case very strongly indeed. And our team in New York, led by Ambassador Geraldine Bernays, is doing a fantastic job in driving this thing in New York. But it's also been supported all over the world by our diplomats everywhere they are, and that's important too, because that's kind of us saying, look, we're now a fully developed country, and we have responsibilities. We're no longer hanging on to the coattails of the international community. We're now part of
right.
We're now at the forefront, and we need to play our role more actively. And for example, in peacekeeping, we have a very noble tradition there. We have to continue and develop that role in the future. And then finally, but certainly not least, is the creative side of things, that we're going to try to present our culture internationally more actively, and in parts of the world where maybe it hasn't reached to the same extent.
Yeah.
Obviously, in America, it's a very well developed. But we are of course investing, as you know, in the Irish Arts Centre here, which is a major project for the future. It's going to make a huge difference to the way Irish culture is presented in America. In Britain, there's also work being done there, and in developing an infrastructure. So basically, it's not that we're going to have an Alliance Française or a Goethe Institute, but I think we will be putting best foot forward more and more around the world, basically saying to people, look, we think we have something here in terms of Irish literature, dance, theatre, film, and so on, that's worth you paying attention to. And the purpose of all of this, of course, is because we have a stake in the future. We want the world to continue to be a place where Ireland can make a good living for our people. Our people can live their lives at home and be healthy, happy, well-educated, and so forth. And therefore, we need to present ourselves to the world. We can't sit back and let the world move around us. We have to be active, including in presenting our culture to the world as something that we believe represents the essence of Ireland.
Between now and 2025, that being the D-Day of this Irish globalization, what do you expect to happen? Obviously, the government is just not giving lip service here. You have a lot of money. You also have, a lot of resources, but you're doing other stuff as well. The Taoiseach now committing $1.2 billion dollars, and needing capital funding for, areas that indeed has needed it. That really, is one would not associate with part of the global investment. So there's a lot happening with culture in Ireland. You're not saying, listen, we've done a hell of a job here, now we're going to take the show on the road. Continuing the development of groups. I know that you had mentioned there the Irish Arts Centre. We're all very happy about that. But there are other, we can take the Irish Repertory Theatre. There are a whole group that actually are getting a lot of support. Do you see yourself in a position to do that around the world, or is it more of a showcase you're bringing?
Well, I think obviously each country is a separate story, and places like the United States are clearly a major focal point for Irish efforts, be they economic, political, cultural, or people-to-people. United States is a class of its own. Britain, likewise, is the nearest neighbour. Our European neighbours that we need to be closer to, our culture is an important part of what we how we connect with them as well. So, but obviously, in more distant places, we won't be opening an Irish Arts Centre in some place some faraway place
right.
that we have little connection with. So in other words, it'll be, but each of our embassies will have a role in developing a program, a local program in their area, which makes sense from the point of view of that area. But there are certain things about Ireland that travel very well. Our traditional music travels very well all over the world.
Right.
No matter where you go. Our literature travels very well because English is the second language of most people in the world. So it travels well. It doesn't even need to be translated in many cases. So there's a lot of things we can offer to the world. But America's a special case because of the sheer scale of mm. Irish America. 33 million people, and then a lot more people have an affinity with Ireland, not even maybe have Irish blood, but they have a sense that they want to be connected with Ireland. So this is always going to be a major target audience for us. But we are looking also at areas of the world that we maybe haven't been as active in before, and the fact that we're opening embassies. Every embassy we open around the world opens up a new set of links that we can cultivate.
This is not just for cultural links. When you open embassies in new countries,
economic, political,
economic,
and so forth, cultural,
and culture. The five Irish government ambassadors, now cultural ambassadors, include names that we know, very well, Martin Hayes and Shelley McNamara. Yvonne Farrell, you have Ruth Negge, and of course Paul Muldoon. They're prominent in the arts, they're prominent in culture. No harm to send them out and to let them go out. And I think it's going to be probably it shows, again, how sincere Ireland is in bringing culture. Again, as you open up new missions in new countries.
Well, I mean, we're lucky that we have, as a country, a lot of people, artists in various fields, that have a global profile. I mean, not many countries in the world can boast actors of the profile of Ruth Negge and Liam Neeson. And, there's a whole string of Irish actors, Saoirse Ronan, and so on, doing extremely well. So they are the face of Ireland, because when people think about Ireland, that's what they think of, and that's not a bad thing in my view.
Yeah.
Of course, someone like Paul Muldoon would be renowned in the world of poetry because he's a leading global poet, and likewise Martin Hayes is a music performer of the highest caliber, and I think has been recognised around the world. So we're lucky to have these kind of people who are willing to put best foot forward for Ireland, because they can open doors, they can say things, they can get an audience of a kind that someone that doesn't have their profile will struggle to get.
I want to thank you. It took us long enough to catch up with you, God knows. But I am I'm delighted to meet you, and to meet you in the in the Irish Consulate here in New York. And as we look through many decades, my own case coming up to 50 years, still people are asking me, am I going to get, what's my day job? And do I think I'll ever go back? I want to again point out that the government of Ireland, through the consulates and through your own good offices, they're very open to help people. There may have been a period of time when we looked at the consulate and said, well, that's where you go to get your passport. The consulates and indeed the embassy have been extraordinarily very much a part of our of our community. We thank you for that.
You're very, very welcome. I know that when I was in London in particular, some of the sort of retired Irish people there would tell me that there was a time when they didn't feel the embassy was part of them, that the embassy was kind of separate from them. Whereas now I think our embassies around the world are very well connected with our community, but also with our local contacts, including here in America. So the embassy is a place where people meet, and we hope that good things happen when people meet on the Irish Embassy premises, be they Irish, Irish-American, or people of different nationalities, when we bring them in, we try to connect them with Ireland in any way we can. But thank you very much for the chance to speak to your audience. I look forward to talking to you again at some time in the future.
Thank you. Again, very special guest friends, Ambassador of Ireland to the United States of America, Dan Mulhall. And you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA.